Okay, we're going to talk a little more broadly than that, though that's perhaps will receive the most attention. So, can this light be turned off? So I thought it might be useful if I spent just a few minutes giving you timelines on LIGO and where things stand and what's needed in terms of binary black hole problem. Then I will talk a little bit about the intermediate binary black hole problem and about the minimal strain lapse and shift, choice of lapse and shift as a candidate tool for use in the IBBH problem. Then Kashif Alvi, who's a graduate student in our group, will talk about initial data for the binary black hole problem that are produced by matched asymptotic expansions combining the Schwarzschild solution with the post-Newtonian approximation. And then, so I'll talk for about half an hour, Kashif for about 20 minutes, and then about 10 minutes, Michele Vallisneri, who's also a grad student in our group, about another issue in black hole neutron star binaries of neutron star tidal disruption, which I just wanted to alert people to the fact that there is a real need also for numerical relativity modeling here for LIGO. So that's where we're going to go. Those few people, if any, who have not seen a picture of LIGO, this is what LIGO in Hanford, Washington looked like from the air, or in Hanford, Washington from the air. I guess that's right. That's right, yeah. Looked like from the air as of, this must be a year and a half old at least. And so this is a rather mature facility now. When I think about how it was, it's just a gleam in the eyes of a bunch of people a few years ago, not so long ago. This is what it looked like down inside the corner station on February 5th, 1998. So this is a year ago. The vacuum system was already in. Or two years ago, the vacuum system was already in, getting mounted into place. This is April 15, 1999. They are putting into place the mirrors, in this case not for the main interferometer, but for a mode cleaning interferometer, which is a smaller sized interferometer that's used to strip off everything except the TEM00 mode of the light before it gets injected in. At the present time, they are mounting the full interferometers in the vacuum systems at both sites. They're farther along at Hanford. They have actually locked one arm of the 2-kilometer interferometer at Hanford as of maybe 5 weeks ago now. So they're moving forward at a measured pace, and they expect to have an operating interferometer by sometime like this summer. To be able to do engineering runs next year and to begin the first science run 2 years from now. That is January in 2002. But this is all very real now, and if you go up there, it's very impressive to see, either to Hanford or to Livingston, Louisiana. Yes, so at Hanford there are two interferometers run in the same vacuum system, a 2-kilometer interferometer and a 4-kilometer interferometer. So we actually have three interferometers in LIGO. The reason is to be sure that we can remove spurious events by having two truly independent interferometers, two semi-independent interferometers, which have the additional feature that any real signal should be half as strong on the 2 kilometers on the 4 kilometer. It may very well turn out that we don't need the 2-kilometer interferometer to remove spurious noises. We don't need to keep it at 2 kilometers, and if so, it will be converted into a 4-kilometer interferometer. So we then will have 3 4-kilometer interferometers. But that will be further downstream after experience, presumably in LIGO 2. That's a very serious possibility in LIGO 2. Now, in terms of expectations for sensitivities, I'm showing here the noise in the interferometers in strain per root hertz. So if you want a theorist dimensionless noise level, you multiply by the square root of the frequency. This is LIGO 1, which is a design goal of interferometers that are fully designed. The components have all arrived at Hanford, are arriving at Livingston, and they're being put together. The R&D for these instruments terminated something like a year and a half ago, and all of the R&D for the past year and a half has been on LIGO 2. LIGO 2 are the first enhancements of LIGO 1. So LIGO 1 is expected to operate for about 3 years under current benchmark or reference design plans to operate 2002, 2003, 2004. And then they go in, open up, and they make some rather major changes to the interferometers to improve them. No radical changes in the sense of some radical redesign. It's basically doing everything better, plus inserting a signal recycling mirror in order to be able to shape the noise curves in whatever manner you wish. And so LIGO 2 then, under current planning, would operate, take a year or so to mount the new interferometers, and would operate in a period around 2006 to 2008. This number is soft. It could be 2007 to 2010. We really don't know. The firming up of these dates and of LIGO 2 is something that will be going on over the next several years. The reference noise curves as of this autumn, this is the noise curves for a possible design, are what I have shown here. And using signal recycling, one can, for example, take photons that would normally be used to produce good sensitivity at 100 hertz and shove them up into the region, say, around 500 or 600 hertz in order to search for low-mass X-ray binaries such as SCOX-1 up in here if you wanted to. So you do narrow banding by moving photons out of a frequency region where you don't want them and into a frequency region where you may prefer to have them. And so this will have that kind of capability. And so here we show three possible noise curves for each one achievable by simply changing the characteristics of the signal recycling mirror, one mirror at the output of the interferometer. Three separate noise curves that you might use for different scientific purposes in LIGO 2. Each of the three of them might well be used perhaps simultaneously in different interferometers. We're running three interferometers perhaps at different times. But there is a noise curve that is optimized for going after inspiraling binaries, which is this dark black one. There's a noise curve that is used if you want to do broadband studies going up to relatively high frequencies approaching a kilohertz, which is this brown one, and a noise curve designed to go after periodic sources near 500 or 600 hertz, such as low-mass X-ray binaries. The improvement in sensitivity for inspiraling binaries from LIGO 1 to this particular reference noise curve is a factor of 20. We always previously were quoting factors of 10, and we may well wind up at a factor of 10. There are some serious technical issues in getting this next factor of 2, but I think most of us are pretty confident of getting a factor of 10, which is 1,000 in event rate, and there's a possibility of getting something approaching 20. My personal guess is we'll get about a factor of 15, but my personal guess is different today than it was a month ago before we discovered a new noise source that we've been struggling with. So this is the standard quantum limit for a 30 kilogram test mass. This is where the center of mass degree of freedom of the test mass has a half width of the Schrodinger wave function that is equal to the is constraining the sensitivity of the interferometer. LIGO 2 in this reference design is at the standard quantum limit basically over the entire frequency band from about 350 hertz down to something like 40 hertz. So we're nearly a factor of 10 in frequency. It's being constrained by quantum mechanical behavior of a 30 kilogram sapphire mirror. My guess is that we may be up from here by a factor of 1.5 in this amplitude noise curve based on some noise issues that some of us are struggling with right now. But we're going to be very close to this. And if we were going with few silica test masses, if we were going with 10 kilogram test masses, which is what is in LIGO 1, or 11 kilogram, the standard quantum limit would be up here. The reason we've gone to 30 kilogram is because the standard quantum limit is constraining us rather unpleasantly at 11 kilograms, which is the LIGO 1 test mass. As I say, there are serious noise issues that we have to be surmounted to get into this ballpark, but I think it's quite reasonable to expect a factor 10, if not this full factor 20. Just to put that in the context of inspiraling binaries, neutron star binaries, which of course are our most certain source, the estimates haven't changed much, though the underlying analysis has changed a lot. In the last 10 years, of order 1 per year at 200 megaparsecs, which corresponds to this level. I'm drawing these curves at a height such that the distance above the noise curve is a measure of, well, let me start over again. One imagines doing data analysis in such a way is to optimize your capability to find signals, and that involves setting a threshold at a level where the spurious event rate is, say, once every 10 or once every 100 years. And the height that I draw a noise curve above is equal to the ratio of the signal strength to the threshold. So these noise curves are not drawn the way one typically has in the past. There is some detailed data analysis algorithm that underlies where I draw the signal strength. That data analysis algorithm then is used to place a signal strength curve at a location such that this height is your signal strength above threshold. So anything that you see that sticks up above the noise curve is detectable with the planned algorithms. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yes, this assumes just LIGO and assumes that you use Virgo to build additional confidence. And so this assumes two LIGO interferometers, two 4-kilometer and one 2-kilometer LIGO interferometers. That's right. Then you can do a little better with those. But you could take a different attitude. This is one LIGO and one Virgo interferometer with the other LIGO interferometer just to build up confidence. That's the way this is particularly done.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon? No. Well, this is based on optimal signal filtering using matched filters for inspiraling binaries. And it doesn't matter whether it's done using fast Fourier transforms with analytic templates or whether you're, I mean, there are a variety of ways to do it, but this just assumes optimal. Pardon? Oh, okay, so at this point, signal noise ratio for the LIGO network, it would be 8. And so in each interferometer, it's a little over 5.
Okay.
Well, the new noise source that we're currently worrying about may push this up by a factor of 1.5. It's a small effect, but a 1.5 is a factor of 3 in event rate. The improvement from here to a factor 10 improvement, which would get us to a noise curve at this level, going from there to here, will be 1,000 in event rate. And I'm worrying about the last factor 10 in event rate. And I think we're likely to wind up actually with maybe a factor 3,000 in event rate is my personal current guess. People who are responsible for stuff won't quote anything, but I have no responsibility, so I can quote numbers. Okay. And so my personal current personal guess is we'll pick up a factor 3,000 in event rate. I'd be quite surprised if we don't pick up a factor 1,000. If we're lucky, we'll pick up a factor 10,000 going from LIGO 1 to LIGO 2. But there's a lot of developmental work that has to be done for LIGO 2, a lot of R&D before we will be down in this ballpark. And that's the R&D that's currently going on. In fact, it's something like 20 different institutions around the world. For neutron star black hole binaries, the current best estimates would give strengths at this level about halfway between LIGO 1 and LIGO 2, and very good signal-to-noise ratio in LIGO 2. Michele Vallisneri will talk about the challenge to see the tidal disruption of neutron stars in this frequency region using broadbanded LIGO interferometers or narrow, using LIGO interferometers with a high frequency capability. Let me just say that. But we're interested here today primarily in black hole binaries. And in the last 6 months or so, there has been a major change in astrophysicists' attitudes about black hole binaries. There were seeds of this change already a few years back in earlier work, but it really came home to astrophysicists, particularly Simon Portugues-Vart and Stephen McMillan, and there's an AstroPH article cited there, that in fact, globular clusters are wonderful machines for making binary black holes. And the basic idea is this. Remind you, a globular cluster has something like 100,000 to 1,000,000 stars in it. It has a size of tens of parsecs, maybe 100 parsecs. It's so very high star density. Most globular clusters, at least in galaxies like ours, were formed very early in the life of the galaxy. The massive stars evolved and died and formed black holes, many of them. And so you might form in a globular cluster 10, 20 or more black holes. And through tidal friction, this is just where a black hole moves through the star field and gravitationally deflects the stars it moves past, so they create a wake behind it, and that wake gravitationally pulls on the black hole and slows it down. The black holes sink to the center of the globular cluster, find each other, and you get binaries start to form and some other single black holes. You then get three-body interactions where you've got a binary not very tight, and another black hole gets into the vicinity, and you get a complicated three-body interaction. And one of the three black holes gets thrown off, and the other two get tighter together, and you have a tighter binary than you had before, but there's been a release of gravitational potential energy from this binary black hole, which goes into kinetic energy of the two, and they go flying out, but not in the early stages with enough energy to escape from the globular cluster. So they go out and then move around in the globular cluster and through tidal friction sink back down toward the center. And then this process occurs again. And when it occurs again, this black hole binary gets tighter, and the amount of energy that goes into ejecting these guys is a little higher because you're living off of energy that's in a tighter binary. There's more energy basically available as the binary gets tighter. And so this happens a number of times over and over again, making this binary tighter and tighter until ultimately there's enough energy released that the binary goes shooting out of the globular cluster. But by then it has become tight enough to merge in somewhat less than the age of the universe. So it's as though nature had designed globular clusters just to make binary black holes. And it's a beautiful mechanism that appears to work in simulations, in numerical modeling. Pardon? It was an idea that, it was developed originally analytically, well, through a mixture of simulations and analytic work. These people and their colleagues have done huge numbers of three-body simulations for to see how these kinds of systems behave. Pardon? In a Newtonian regime. Yeah. So these will be the masses of whatever is formed by single stars when they collapse to make black holes. No, but there will be some, there will occasionally be mergers which will produce bigger black holes. We don't know what the masses are, but based on what measured black hole masses we have, which are all in binaries, in primordial binaries generally, the masses are likely to be in the range of 6 to 20 solar masses. Yeah. Because the black holes are heavier, and so they create a stronger wake. And so the time scale for them to sink toward the center turns out to scale, I think, inversely with the mass. And the typical stars in the cluster are like 0.4 solar masses, and these black holes are 6 to 20 solar masses. And so they do this an order of magnitude or more faster than the stars do. Pardon? Not particularly. Well, it depends on making the black holes in the first place. That's all it depends on. So if you push the Portuguese of Art and Macmillan to the wall and ask them, what do you believe are the uncertainties in your estimates, they will tell you LIGO 1 will see something between 0 and about 1 per year. Glimmering globular cluster may make of order 10 or 20 or so black holes and may wind up producing, say, a half a dozen such binaries that get ejected and that merge in less than the age of the universe. There are numbers something like that. I've forgotten precise numbers, but it's like a half a dozen or a dozen such binaries. Yeah.
Have these suggestions of pre-galactic black holes we heard from the Chandra satellite led to any speculation?
Those are for massive black holes, aren't they? And I think those are all for very massive black holes, and those would be of relevance for LISA, but not for LIGO. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. There are also speculations about middle weight black holes that would be in a range, say, 100 solar masses or more or so, which could be very strong LIGO sources. I'm just highlighting this because it's new and because it does give numbers then.
But the astrophysical community, I mean, the astrophysics people, I mean, yeah, that's interesting, but isn't that one good sense of view about
it? I think the astrophysical community regards this as plausible, but highly uncertain. And I think that's a very fair assessment. It's plausible, but highly uncertain. Yeah, but there's a substantial number. Yeah. Yeah. But if you go, when they go through the numbers for this, they get as their best guess. This is their published best guess numbers, such that you would see about one per year in LIGO 1. They revise the numbers downward, so they're now quoting between 0.1 and 0.5 as their best guess per year. This is since publication. But I think the true uncertainties, this is my estimate of the true realistic uncertainties. I wouldn't say zero, but I would say the true realistic uncertainties in how strong this is for once per year is LIGO 1 could see a bunch of them, and you might be pushing LIGO 2 to see them at all. It's really a very uncertain business. But it also epitomizes the fact that this had not been really considered seriously before 6 months ago, epitomizes probably the richness of possibilities that haven't been thought about. One has to be prepared for some real surprises.
Yeah.
The spins, presumably, are the spins that they got primordially from their parent stars. That's right.
And the final number is the same one by a totally independent analysis.
That's right.
You don't quote that because...
Well, no. There's enormous. I think there is even more uncertainty in those modeling calculations than there is here. There are enormous uncertainties in those calculations. And my guess, talking with people, is there's probably less uncertainty here. Besides, this is new. But there are certainly other possibilities. There certainly are other possibilities with field black hole binary. So Postnov and Prokhorov get a high number like this. Portuguese-Vart and it was not Macmillan, but it was he working with somebody else get zero, and so for field binaries. But I think the lesson, the important thing for us is that it is perfectly plausible. Quite plausible that LIGO 1 will see such things. It would be, I think, rather surprising if LIGO 2 doesn't see quite a few, but it's always possible. And of course, theoretical waveforms are needed for search templates and for information extraction. BBH data analysis plans are now proceeding under the sad assumption that you guys will not provide merger waveforms for LIGO 1. And I note that the time when that's needed is next year, since the search begins January the following year. So we've got the consequences for the searches. Well, it depends on how well the algorithms that people like Warren Anderson and Ina Flanagan and company are developing, how well they work, algorithms that don't rely on information, so we don't have information. But I think it's plausible to expect that the loss in signal-to-noise ratio due to not having templates could be as high as a factor of 2. It might be somewhat less than that. If it is as high as a factor of 2, that's an event rate loss of a factor of 10. A factor of 10 event rate loss could very well make the difference between LIGO 1 seeing binary black holes and not. It's a real possibility. I'm not arguing that this is what's going to happen by any means, but it's a real possibility. So there is a very serious need for guidance from this community. And any guidance from the numerical relativity community would be helpful. For example, if we could just have improved estimates of the frequency band in which to look or the waveform duration, that would have quite significant payoffs in the data analysis. So let me turn to the IBBH problem for a few minutes. The IBBH problem, intermediate binary black hole problem, is the fact that we only have complete confidence in in-spiral waveforms up to the point where the separation of the two black holes is, say, of order something like 10 or 12 m. Inside that, you have to, the only methods that we have really are to improve the convergence using Pade approximates, the technique that Damur, Iyer, and Sathur Prakashu developed, or the techniques that Damur is talking about here, his work with Alessandro Buonanno, who is a postdoc now at Caltech and has come down for the day with us. on mapping the comparable mass problem onto the test mass problem. Although these look good, we can't be sure that they're really giving right answers. And the only way we will know for sure, my guess is through either seeing the waveforms and comparing with the waveforms, or through full numerical relativity, doing the problem and comparing. So this is the best thing that we have, and they, as I say, it looks good, but looking good is not enough for data analysis for LIGO and Virgo. And so we, in the absence of a really firm knowledge, we have to assume that Thibault and Alessandra are wrong by some amount and use a much larger family of templates. And this is an issue that has to be scoped out. Thibault is coming up to Caltech in a few weeks, and we hope to have some detailed discussions about that. But the other possibility is to actually do numerical relativity in co-rotating coordinates to get the last part of the n-spiral, say from 12m on inward, where m is the total mass of the system. Patrick Brady, Julian Creighton, and I made some estimates of how big is the region over which we can't have complete confidence at this stage in the n-spiral waveforms. And it's this gap here, so that we have an early stage. If, here is the mass of, this is for equal mass black holes with masses m sub whole, so in units of the mass of the sun. For 2 10 solar mass black holes, standard post-Newtonian waveforms, I think, are really firm up to a frequency of something like 50 hertz, 40 hertz, something like that. Then we get into the region of the IBBH gap, where we are highly reliant on Pauli approximants or the Buonanno-Damore techniques or numerical relativity. And then we have the merger region, the IBBH gap for 2 10 solar mass black holes would end at a frequency around 200 hertz or so, and the merger begins. In LIGO, for 2 12 solar mass black holes in LIGO 1, the IBBH waveform and the merger waveform give equal contributions to the signal to noise. And very little of the signal to noise is coming from the region where we have confidence in the waveforms. And as you go to larger masses, which means stronger signals, it gets worse and worse. On the other hand, for neutron star binaries, you get you're at 300 hertz, where you have something like 95% of the signal noise to the left of here, or 90% of the signal noise coming from the region where you have high confidence. And so the post-Newtonian expansions are very good for the neutron stars, but there's a serious problem for the black holes. So that's the challenge, that we not only need numerical relativity guidance from the merger, but also in the IBBH gap, it seems to me. And so this has led us in work that I'll go over quickly, because it's by now several years old, most of it, to argue that one should make a real effort in numerical relativity to do the IBBH problem in co-rotating coordinates. The goal is to use coordinates that make the components of the metric and extrinsic curvature all evolve on the in-spiral time scale, instead of evolving on the orbital time scale or on the time scale of M, which is the more relevant time scale if you're moving the black hole across the grid. And so this is a far longer time scale, which would mean you could using suitable numerical techniques, one should be able to take much larger time steps and require much less computer power in order to do the evolution if you were to do it in these kinds of coordinates. These coordinates require not only the spatial coordinate grid be co-rotating, which is governed by the shift, but also requires, obviously, an appropriate choice of the lapse. If you choose the wrong lapse, so you're moving time forward more rapidly here than there, you can artificially generate some big time derivatives, and so as time goes on. So you need an appropriate lapse and shift. Yeah. I think it's quite likely in the LIGO case, and not in the it's quite likely in the LIGO case. It's also quite likely in the equal mass LISA case. The place where it's not likely is extreme mass ratios in LISA. Yes, because these are capture binaries, but they capture at a large enough separation that they'll circularize by the time they get. So the payoffs of working in co-rotating coordinates are that during the in-spiral, even the emitted gravitational waves get frozen into the coordinate grid. They're not evolving dynamically. And they, as well as the black hole metric, will evolve on the in-spiral time scale, not the wave period time scale. So it seems to me that if you work in co-rotating coordinates, you can basically freeze out all dynamics if you're clever enough numerically. You don't have to worry about true dynamics. Yeah. You have to have a good enough method. I'm waving my arms. I don't think so. I think that you can develop. I think you should be able to develop numerical schemes that have time steps that are short compared to the in-spiral time scale, and that have radiation reaction that comes in by virtue of the boundary conditions at the outer boundary. But in which you have suppressed all spurious gravitational waves. Which is essential in being able to take the large time steps. But this is very arm-waving, as you might expect. It's coming from me, and I'm not an expert in this subject. It applies, it potentially applies to the boundary conditions. There's an issue of whether we know enough about the outer boundary conditions analytically, plus knowing what the shift looked like in the previous time step. So the issue is boundary conditions on the shift, primarily. When you saw... I would put it out at a few wavelengths. So it's far outside the velocity of light circle. No, it's still frozen in. It's still frozen in. Only to the extent that the orbital angular velocity is changing with time, will it not be frozen in, and that's the in-spiral time scale issue. No. I claim that everything, including the boundary conditions, are more or less frozen in. The difference between outgoing and ingoing wave boundary conditions is just the direction in which the wave pattern spirals. And imposing outgoing wave boundary conditions is almost trivial, I think, in this scheme. But we can argue. I mean, there'll be plenty of opportunity for discussion. Let me just move on.
Play all those questions with scalar gravity.
Yes. 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 Pardon?
Can we do linear outgoing?
Yeah. Sure. Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you can write down an analytic solution in co-rotating coordinates and see what it looks like. Yeah. It's worth maybe emphasizing that people who do star formation calculations, which involves collapsing a very rapidly rotating lump of gas and watching it bifurcate, so Joel Tolling, for example, they have found they can't get decent accuracy working in inertial coordinates. They do it in co-rotating coordinates in Newtonian theory. Well, just quickly reminding you that there's one particular proposal for how to choose the lapse and shift to do this. It's based on an action principle where you minimize you have a space slice on which you want to choose a lapse and a shift in order to move forward to the next space slice. You adjust the lapse and the shift in such a way as to minimize an action. The action is the square of the time derivative of the 3 metric, integrated over the domain of computation, which will have inner boundaries excised around the black holes and outer boundary out here. Let's call that region omega with a boundary d omega. And so it's a simple calculation to see what the Euler-Lagrange equations are for this action, assuming Dirichlet boundary conditions where the shift is fixed on the outer boundary, or well, fixed on all the boundaries. And the result is what's called the minimal strain lapse and shift. The lapse is given analytically in this way in terms of the shift, beta, the extrinsic curvature of the slice you're working on, and the square of the extrinsic curvature, which we call chi. And then, so it's an algebraic equation for the lapse. And then for the shift, it's the standard, is this minimal distortion, Jimmy, equation? What? Is minimal. Yeah, that's for an arbitrary alpha. That's I don't know the right name. Minimal distortion, and so, but what's required is that you feed this choice of alpha into the differential equation, and then that's what is called minimal strain, and so you have a linear differential equation for the shift. Now we've been somewhat optimistic that. This so-called minimal strain equation, then, for the shift would be effective for the IVVH problem. One reason is that Sergio Goncalves in my group has proved that this minimal strain equation is strongly elliptical in certain space-times, which would appear to include, for certain 3 metrics and extrinsic curvatures, which would appear to include those for the IVVH problem. It's not always strongly elliptic. Strongly elliptic means that when you take the terms that involve second time derivatives here and build a matrix then of second time derivatives, feed in an arbitrary vector field in here for the d's, you ask that this matrix the eigenvalues of the matrix all be positive and bounded away from zero. Pardon? Yeah, space derivative. This is all occurring on the 3 slice. I'm sorry. This is all occurring on the 3 slice. The Goncalves' criterion, this is not the form in the paper that he has on the web, but it's equivalent to the form on the paper. I just realized you can state it in this simpler way. The MSE equation is strongly elliptic if and only if everywhere on the domain of integration in the 3 slice, at most one eigenvalue of the extrinsic curvature vanishes. So you can allow one eigenvalue to vanish, but you can't have both eigenvalues vanish. In Schwarzschild space-time, with Schwarzschild slicing, the extrinsic curvature vanishes identically, so the minimal strain equation would not be strongly elliptic. In Lemaître, with the Lemaître slicing, or Edekin Finkelstein slicing, it is strongly elliptic. And I've written down a testbed metric, just an analytic metric that resembles what you would expect for binary black holes, and Sergio has checked it numerically for that testbed metric and found that it is strongly elliptic. Okay. Yes? We presume that you begin with something that's very close to the correct space-time in a post-Newtonian regime and integrate forward from there. And so it's our hope that if you begin close enough to the desired solution and you're wise enough about the choice of the boundary conditions, that you will evolve successfully then with this.
So what about the boundary conditions?
Okay, well, this is my last transparency. So there is the standard theorems from the math literature, which basically say that with sufficiently smooth situations, that you have and with Dirichlet boundary conditions, that is, you specify the value of the shift on the boundary, so that's on the black hole boundaries and on the external boundary, that there exists a unique analytic solution. We've also shown that there does exist a solution. Forget about boundary conditions. You'd have to impose the right boundary conditions to follow it. But there does exist a solution that does track the inspiral in the way that we want. We know that from a perturbation theory analysis of the equations. And so I think we have a pretty convincing case that if you manage to be wise enough in your choice of boundary conditions, that a numerical implementation ought to be able to track the inspiral in the manner that we wish. However, Bernd Brugmann has tried implementing this and has not had any particular success. Do you want to comment on that for a minute, Bernd?
This is a wrong statement.
This isn't public. But still, there is, other than your effort, there's been no effort to test this numerically. It's just. Okay. Yeah. You've. Okay. With what kind of slicing? Okay. Again, I mean, one has to be careful with.
Yeah, actually, let me just address this image question. Mm-hmm. What we do is we take an existing space time and evolve a slice of that. And so on each slice, we can solve the BCP gauge to find the last.
What is the BCP gauge?
So the one that does Brady, Brayton, and Thorne, the one that
one. What I call minimal strain. Okay, I don't know. You mean the theorem about existence of analytic, uniqueness of existence of analytic? Yeah, I don't know. I have not dug through the mathematics literature. What are the conditions for existence and uniqueness? If you have a strongly elliptic second order quasi-linear differential equation with Dirichlet. Pardon?
I told you, when I was in Caltech, that this is a hard problem.
Yeah, you said it was a hard problem, but I also thought you pointed me to some books where I thought I was finding some answers.
We see that the binaries in their simulation are still from the clusters with high explosivity effects.
Yeah.
They estimate the lifetime using a brain frequency of about 0.8, I think.
Yeah.
And using Adrian's estimated in an early paper by Peters, I can't remember if Peters or Peters is how the explosivity is involved.
Yeah. Well, if you do that evolution, I mean, we've checked that. I didn't, but I think Scott Hughes or somebody in our group did. It will circularize to a very high degree by the time the merger occurs, because the semi-major axis is still pretty big at that stage. So there's plenty of time for circularization. That's not the case in these LISA contexts I referred to, but it is the case here.
I would like to understand the requirement.
Okay. So the boundary conditions you have to specify are on the shift. The lapse comes out automatically afterwards. On the shift, the places where you have to impose boundary conditions are near or inside some apparent horizon and out in the radiation zone. Now, out in the radiation zone, you know just from perturbation theory what the solution ought to look like. And my guess is that you will know enough. I mean, you're trying to make these coordinates be co-rotating. My guess is that you will know enough from the shift that was working in previous time steps, and from analytic analyses, to be able to guess a good shift. You're not looking for some precise shift. You're just looking for something that will enable the coordinates to track reasonably well the N-spiral. So if your guess is not all that good, well, you just won't track all that well. And the inside, you presumably want something like ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, and so the shift will be to a fair extent governed by that, and you can control it in that way. But yes, for each black hole, that's right. My guess is that from analytic arguments, we will also be able to figure out more or less what we need to keep it co-rotating. Again, I emphasize, you don't need the correct solution. The worse your guess, you just don't track as well. But if it's true that if the existence and uniqueness theorem is true in this case, as the numerical effort suggests, maybe there's something wrong. But if it's true in this case, you specify a shift, you get a solution, a unique solution, and it will do better or worse depending on how clever you were in that specification.
Can you solve this now working with the separation
In that limit, you'll have vanishing extrinsic curvature, and the differential equation will go bad. So you've got to keep the separation finite. You've got to keep the rotation rate finite. But I would guess so. I would guess you can. But look, we've done very little work on that.
That's why I was just asking you, because the shift conditions are actually minimal. That problem has two local minimum.
I'm sorry, which problem has two local minimum?
Just let that curve, like the standard.
slicing, boiling.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the shift.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're looking at
inside the urban region with the solar rotation core.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the variational principle has a formal solution for either boundary condition that shift is zero at the
mm-hmm.
horizon, or if the generalization of the Neumann condition for a vector.
Mm-hmm. I see. Mm-hmm.
Is zero. And one of the minima is much lower than the other.
Mm-hmm.
But this might actually affect the skin
mm-hmm.
quite a bit, even though you're not going to the right, you're
mm-hmm.
going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a question like, it's like you have a disc rotating
mm-hmm.
around something.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, does the thing that's rotating, the platform, is it connected to the center thing with
mm-hmm.
all bearings?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it actually stuck to it?
Mm-hmm.
And those are two different sets of boundary conditions
mm-hmm.
that both have solutions in general. So the shift part, I don't know
mm-hmm.
about the last part.
Mm-hmm.
That's your
mm-hmm.
condition
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm just suggesting that
mm-hmm.
this topic is
mm-hmm.
Because you don't want automatically
yeah.
to use your solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without
yeah.
necessarily
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Carson and I sort of looked at that
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And roughly speaking, it seems like if you want sort of a good rafting shift for the rotating cases, what you want is a rafting shift where if you hand it a space time that is time independent, it finds that the revolution field is still there. Now, the base you propose.
This will not, no.
But so does the null gate proposed by Smart and York.
Well,
so what I'm wondering about is why can't we get these Smart and York gates?
I don't know how the Smart-York gauge will do in this situation, but what we propose has real problems for a truly time-independent situation. In that the truly time-independent situation, your extrinsic curvature is going to vanish. Okay, with appropriate slicing, you're all right. Okay, I thought you were implying a slicing. Try it and see. I mean,
Do you want
to minimize, you want the very slow time rate of change of all the components of the space-time metric. And that's all that you want in order to be able to take long time steps. And in order to freeze out the dynamics. Yeah.
Therefore, have much freedom in that you can get things which do have a property that you want,
which might have totally wrong with the problem, because it's entangled anyway.
Yeah.
Well,
part of making this work is really imposing the right kinds of boundary conditions. Yeah.
Very slow, but I finally got my mind around your existence here. And of course, what you really mean is the federal alternative. Right? If you've got a nihilistic operator and it has uniqueness properties, then you're guaranteed existence. And you don't give a damn about the function space you're doing it in or anything like that. Basically, you don't care very much about the boundary conditions that you need to make sure
That's right. But if you get the uniqueness with a particular kind of boundary condition, then you're a whole frame. Once you pick boundary conditions and get uniqueness, you're a whole frame.
And it depends very well on the
No, you do an existent, you do an numerical experiment, and if it works, you're done.
Yeah.
But, Vince?
That's not the way you do it.
Vince?
Sure, but the problem you're discussing, but as far as I know, there's some complication with the spectralistic equation.
I see.
So we have the difficulty in our vector spatially harmonic gauge condition of trying to show that didn't really happen. And it took a miracle of our gauge condition to avoid that apparent lack of smoothness of the shift from screwing up the evolution.
So what you're saying here is that our differential equation will involve first derivatives of the extrinsic curvature. And this may cause problems?
Well, possibly there, but also the second derivative of the spatial metric to the fact that in a vector, the Laplacian vectors has derivatives with the
spatial. Okay. I'm not implementing this. I think maybe we should quit. There are two more shorter talks to be given. Why don't we break for a couple of minutes and let people stretch, and then Kashif and Michaela talk.